Howdy everyone, welcome to the Render Gathering and the sessions that we call the Uninfluencer Sessions. And today I'm really privileged and honoured actually to have not just a special guest but a special friend, someone that's done so many amazing things in their own life but also in the lives of other people, has made a massive impact and is such an influence to others. So the Uninfluencer Sessions are all about not so much growing platforms but growing stories and telling people's stories in a real raw and authentic way. And today, like I said, we have a very beautiful and special friend of mine and of many, but again, personally, that I love to call friend. And that's a person that's affectionately known by the title of Auntie Carms. But I'm going to let Carmen introduce herself. So Carms, welcome. Thank you for being here. And if you want to tell us a little bit about who you are and maybe just quickly where you're from, a bit of your whakapapa.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's such a privilege to spend time with you, Cliff, and all the mahi that you do. I'm nervous, which is crazy because I love a good chat, but thank you for listening in and tuning in. I'm Carmen Taplin. I am born and bred in Papakura, South Auckland. Went to Papakura High School. All my family were born at the Papakura Obstetric Hospital. That's just how it rolled back then. I am the third eldest of six children. And, I have I spent most of my life in Papakura, and I was one of those rat bag children. I'm a good human, I promise, but I was the one that would push the boundaries with my parents, and I apologize to them still to this day about the everything I put them through. But I was that child that kind of did everything that your parents said you shouldn't, and which led me to the exciting little journey of my life. I am today. So I have a beautiful husband, Spencer, and four beautiful children, Jordan, Peyton, Ivana, and Ayla Rain. And yeah, just loving life at
great.
The moment.
Thank you, Carms. And obviously we're going to get to talk a little bit about where you are and what you're doing now. We'll do that at the end. But again, let's pick up on that thread. You mentioned about being born and raised in South Auckland, in particular Papakura. Not only what was that experience like, but do you think now, as you look back on your years, how has that formed and influenced who you are? Because we know South Auckland has a reputation, and that reputation's quite varied from some real positives, but also there are some real there can be some negative things and perceptions about South Auckland. So what has it been like? What was it like for you, that experience being growing up in South Auckland, and how has it formed who you are today?
I think I absolutely loved my childhood. You know, I think I've had some battles, of course, over the years, but there is just a richness in community and the closeness of our community. And yes, there was, you know, the stigma around, I think, as I got older, because when I was little, it was just the perfect place to be. Like, there was no gates on schools and locked, you know, everything. It was just amazing. Yeah, we would play with the neighbours. We're outside. You know, growing up, Mum would be, as soon as she fed us, I'm pretty sure she fed us, but there's six of us, so that would have taken a lot. But we were, like, kicked out the door, see you at tea time, and, you know, the lights would go on, and we were there. We were always safe. And, you know, I'm so connected to the community still. But you're right, the stigma around South Auckland, especially now as we've gotten older, and I don't know why that is as much, but I'm so proud of where I come from. I think the beautiful and humbling thing about being from Papakura and out south is the gratitude for what we had or have as a community. And I know society has changed a lot now, but I was always so proud of where I come from. And I love even more so now as I'm older, when people go, there is a little bit of judgment, you know, oh, where do you come from? And when you say it, you can see everyone like, you're from somewhere like that. And I'm like, you know, I love that. I love to kind of be the that little bit of a rogue.
And in terms of what you've done, and again, we'll get to that in a moment, you know, it's very inspiring to, and I think that's the story to be told, right, Carms? That it doesn't matter where you start, you can make a fist of things, and you can turn things around, and great things can come from, not bad places, but great things can come from anything if you're willing to see the beauty in your surroundings. And I agree with you, like, there's so much richness and talent in South Auckland. I think that some of the stuff that endears me to come, that has brought me back over the years from when I've traveled away and worked away, to I always somehow find myself back tied back to my roots back here at home. So you growing up out here in South Auckland, for anyone that does know you, knows you're obviously involved in rugby league quite heavily and have been for some time. Before we go into that, you mentioned your husband, Spence. And for those that know Spencer, also know that Spencer's a great man and loves his footy as well. But more than loves his footy, he loves people. So how was it that the world came to be that two of the most loving people found each other and ended up together? Do you want to give us a bit of a story about how, you know, sort of yourself and Spencer and what he does? But yeah, but how did that come to be? That would be interesting to hear.
Yeah, sure. To be honest, it's a little bit like a fairy tale when I think about it. So as I talked about earlier, I was a bit of a rat bag, and my parents were very strict, and you know, you weren't allowed to talk to boys, let alone like kiss them or anything. So, but again, I just I really pushed the boundaries there, and I thought, I want a boyfriend, and Dad was like, no way. And so I ran away from home. That was my answer. So anyone listening, that is not the answer, but that's what my answer was. I was 16. I had a baby at that age. I was with an older man, and the relationship wasn't great. But my baby was born with a blood disorder, Cosman syndrome, they call it, where she couldn't make neutrophils, the white blood cells. So we were in and out of hospital for 4 years, mainly in hospital, then out. And in that time, me and her dad separated really early. I think I was 18. And but Spencer, my sister, was married to a beautiful man, Charlie Hirawini, and his first cousin was Spencer Taplin. And so whenever we had fun or gatherings, you know, as you do, there's always like, oh, there's always that cousin. And Spencer was always the cousin. Talented sports person, just a beautiful human, doesn't drink, lost both his parents quite tragically very early too. So he was just the guy that everybody loved, you know. He'd light the room up. He's so funny. He'd dance. And so I would look at him and think, wow, he's awesome, you know, like what a cool human. But I think after going through everything I went through when I was younger, my self-esteem was just so low. Like I never looked at him and thought, oh, I could have, you know, and I could be something. But the beautiful thing about him is he adored my baby. Like he become more into like a, not a father role because he's still a baby himself, but just he would fuss over her. He just got that. That's what she needed. And he was there for her. He'd just turn up and visit. He'd drop his boys into town at the nightclubs in Auckland and then come drive to me, and we would just sit outside for hours. And he would counsel me. You know, I'm a year, like nearly 2 years older than him. But I suppose he made me really think about be grateful for the things that I do have, you know, with him having lost his parents. And then... sadly, she became so ill. She passed away in January 96. And when we knew we didn't have long, he was one of the first ones I called because he was the only one that could light her world up. You know, not even me as her mom or her dad or anyone could light it up like he could. And so he was there when she passed, and he had been there for me since that day, and just wouldn't leave me by myself because he'd lost love, and he had grieved, and he was like, no, I'm not letting you go through this on your own. And we were just great friends for a little bit before, you know, it turned into something romantic.
No, and look, if I can.
But,
I mean, I think there's something to be said there, first of all, for any young single men out there. That's how you get it done, boys. You take time and you listen and be a good human being. But apart from that, you know, why I say that's special is because, you know, it's not too common in our day and age that you would have people be so selfless and so serving purely for the, the way you put it, Carms, that would just do it to light someone else's world up. And I think that's half the challenge that we have today is we're not interested in lighting up the world of other people. We're interested in lighting up the world of ourselves. Mm. And, you know, and when we get to talk about leadership, you know, I think that's one of the things I'm hearing already in the great lessons is, you know, that I'm thinking about writing down is how do you make your day about lighting up someone else's? So that's pretty special. Mm. And then just going into, I mean, I appreciate also you share the intimacy of your story with the tragic passing of your baby. And without going into any sort of real details about it, but, you know, that must have been obviously challenging for you as a young mum. So for anyone that, and it doesn't have to be necessarily that, but on that point, Carms, like, how does a person like you, who is so loving and sincerely kind and gracious and patient and all of those things, how do you continue to be that when you've been through such a tragic loss like that? The simple question is, how does a person keep going? What was your experience? Do you mind sharing a little bit with us about that? Is that okay?
Yeah, I think to be honest, when she passed, it's almost like, and I'm sure everyone experiences it, when you go through that process, you know, the tangi and everything, I was fine. I felt fine because I had all that support around me. But it was the moment that everyone went back to their normality, whereas because we'd been in hospital together, it was just her and I for a long time, and that was my life, and she was my life. So I struggled. I started to feel like, oh, it's not fair. Like, how come everyone else gets to go back and be fine and get on with life and I can't, you know, I'm struggling here. But what the turning point for me was, the crossroads for me was my beautiful husband, because he was there, and it was just that reminder, like, hey, you know, man, there's so much to be grateful for here, you know, look at what you did for her. And just reminded me of the things, because a lot of the time, and for years later, I felt guilt as a mum, because I was 21 when she passed away, that I didn't do enough. And so for years I battled with that. I didn't realise that was the battle I was having until I took my own advice years down the track and went and spoke to a counsellor about, gosh, why am I feeling like this, and was able to unpack things. And I just think if I'd known earlier, I may have been able to work through things better. But it was more about that, you know, that life, these things happen. I look at it now and say the bumps in the road are there on purpose, because I journeyed the way I have journeyed. But the key thing I think that got me through is having good people around you, and being vulnerable in that space, and not going, oh, yeah, I'm all good, sweet as, and then go down a destructive path of grief, because I could have easily done that. Before Spencer came into my life, I was like with my daughter's father, the people I was hanging out with, the things I was doing, is so out of character for me now. When I look back, I was just trying to belong. I was trying to fit in what I thought was my life. But surrounding myself with good people and listening, you know, being there for them and then being there for me, that was a huge. And I suppose that's probably why I try and be that for others now.
Yeah, because you know the value of it. You've gone through the experience of how powerful it is, right, to be that person, to be there. It's interesting. Last night we had a really cool wellbeing waka session we partnered a number of franchises. And we'll talk about the wellbeing waka, everybody. That's the Brains Trust is here, where that came from. But we had this amazing session last night where we brought two elite sporting groups together, crossed codes, two franchises. And as we're having the kōrero about it, we're talking about, you know, because I landed back at a simple place that you need good people to talk to, and you need good people around you. If you have those things, it helps more than you realize. It's not the only tool, but it's a big tool. And it's to what you're saying here. And last night there were a couple of young athletes in the room who put their hand up and said, and actually messaged me late last night and said, Cliff, I'm so thankful for the session because it helped me really realize that I need to talk about what's going on and that I actually have good people around me that I can do that with. And that's the big thing for us calms. Like I say this often too, I don't need to be that guy for you if you've got someone great in your life. But if you don't, I'm here. I'm happy to be. But it's not about me and about you needing me, whether I'm the chaplain or in a well-being role as a pastor, you know. And I remember I said to one person a while ago, which was like, you know, they were telling me about some of their stuff, and I said, you know what, because they came to me as their pastor, and I said, well, you know what, I think what you need, you might need a counselor, you might need some counseling on that specific issue. And they said to me, oh, yeah, but I've got you. And I said, look, yes, that's good, I'm here, but I said, you can have a pastor and a counselor as well. It's not exclusively one or the other. And I said, if there are people out there that can give you what you need, then press into that, and it's the courage to do so. So, Carms, I think you are a real great example of the power of not just overcoming, but the example of ensuring that good people are around you, ensuring that you rely on those big those good people and share with them. So can I ask you this then about that whole – I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. I know I promised to take care of you, and I will, but I'm just going to ask you this. Like, from that learning or from your experience, how did that help grow resilience in you? Because I know resilience is a thing that it's a great buzzword at the moment, and people say, yes, build resilience. But what do you think was a simple learning tool thing that through that circumstances help build resilience in you so that you can genuinely and sincerely keep going and smile and appreciate life, but not masking that, because loss is loss, right? And you mentioned grief, and I say it often that some things you just won't get over, because if your heart, a chunk of your heart's gone, you can't just replace that. So how do we build the resilience to keep going even though we've experienced loss? What is that maybe for you? What do you think about resilience and what helped you?
I think for me, like with my daughter, with Jordan, she'd be 30, 31, coming up 31, which is great, blows my mind actually. But I always feel like I say to people, sometimes when they say, oh, you know, explain your relationship with her. And I say, and I mean this as respectfully as I can, she was like my Jesus Christ.
Okay.
She was I feel like she came to me for that short time and she gave her life for me. She came, she gave me the lessons that I needed. So a lot of the, you know, when we talk about resilience, we're in the oncology, hematology ward at the Starship. She was 9 months old and then passed there as well, so 4.5. And that whole time I met so many beautiful families. And we loved and lost many times. I mean, back then, you know, when people might go, gosh, we keep giving money to all these different things or the Cancer Society and that, but the growth in like the, so I think when she was sick, it was 20% right. survival rate compared to now is like 20% mortality. So it's absolutely flipped. So it's, and that warms my heart knowing that all of the money and all of the support that people are doing are saving, save so many lives. But back then it was all often we had lost so many, she lost so many friends and we lost so many friends. And, but the resilience for me was the journey started way back then in that ward when I would see families. And that was the thing about it. It was, there was no bias in who was impacted. So that was the other reason, you know, they took this girl from South Auckland going, oh, why me, why me? And then I get in here and there's, it didn't matter where I was from. Like I had people that had lots of money, people that had no money, people that were in prison, people that were doctors, police officers, you know, it was, didn't matter what nationality. And we were all, we would sit outside all the time. I used to smoke cigarettes too then, which, I gave up when I was 21, I promise, because my husband was like, I don't date chicks that smoke.
Good man.
So, so I was like, smoking. But I would spend so much time outside with parents, with people, smoking cigarettes, but sharing stories. And that was when I was like, again, you know, that power in being there for others, that power of listening, power of journeying with others, made me realize, shit, sister, you got nothing. You know, like, yes, what we're going through is tough. But when I look at these inspiring people who have been through like mega loads much more than me, and they're still telling me how much I'm uplifting them, you know, so that kind of was a real help. I just saw my perspective on life changed. Yeah. And for me, so then, and now when I look at it, when things are tough, even, you know, now if I'm juggling 20 million things.
Which you are, by the way.
I always go, okay. But when it gets like that, I think, you know, no, okay, it's a bit tough at the minute, but gosh, you know, look at all these things we've been able to do. Let's just, so it is, things might get rough, but like you say, lean on people. Because I, and in the work that I do, you know, I say, I'm here for you. It takes a long time for anyone to go, for real? Because of that, I imagine that juggle when you're in yourself going, oh, I don't want to be a hoha.
Yeah.
Oh, they've already got enough on their plate. They've got heaps going on. I just won't share. And, again, if today is another opportunity to say, please, please reach out and have that support. If they're there and they say they're there, then use it, because that's what's been – the difference, I think, for me is I've leant on those who have said, I'm there for you.
Yeah, so and just sort of distilling all of that, you know, some of the key things there around perspective of your situation, but also of those that are going around, that are around you and that are living life as well. And I love that, you know, that when, you know, health or even mental health, it doesn't discriminate, right? It'll pick anybody at any time, and we all experience it. So having a bit of perspective around other people's scenarios, situations, what's going on for them, what's going on for you, and then, like you said, gratefulness and gratitude for what we do have and what we have learned and what we have in the future, if we have a tomorrow, if we have breath in our lungs today, that we have another opportunity to make things work and work through. All those beautiful things comes coming out of your kōrero, which is really important. And then again to that, like really looking for good people you can trust that. And I think for us too, that if people are coming to us to not be judgmental, to listen and be willing.
Mm-hmm.
And when we offer help, be willing, actually willing to give it. I remember very early on, and I say this often now to our leaders, that if you're having a really rubbish day, the best way to get over that is or to get past that or through that is find something good to do for somebody else. Find a way to serve.
Yes.
Right? If you serve, it shifts your perspective, but it also moves your heart. That it's not diminishing what you're going through, but again, like you were saying, a bit of perspective really does help, and it helps build that resilience as well. And again, that's not diminishing what people are going through, because everyone experiences different things and trauma.
Yeah.
But on that, Kōrero Kāms, just really appreciate you being able to share with us that, because that's very obviously very personal for you and Spencer and your whānau. But I know people that watch this and listen to this will learn and glean so much from your honesty and transparency around it. If I can move us forward a little. That was sort of that early adulthood part of your life, and you carry that with you wherever you go. And as we begin to talk about this next stuff, it obviously shapes who you are and what you've done and who you've become. But at what point, I mentioned a bit earlier that you got involved in rugby league, all right? And now, like I said, you're affectionately known to many as Auntie Kāms. And that comes, though, with a lot of – that's very not just endearing, but it actually comes with a lot of respect and mana. But where did that journey in rugby league start for you? Because being obviously – we know rugby league is a gladiatorial sport, and in the last few years especially, our wahine have come through and it's starting to get more notoriety in sport in general. But, you know, historically it was a hard man's game and it was a male-dominated sport, male figures around it. So how did someone like yourself carve their way into this hard man's game and get your start, and how was that, and where did you begin?
Well, funny thing is, it started in the community of Manurewa at the Marlins.
Yeah.
So I used to work at Counties Manukau Sport with Carla Matua, who I know that you're close with, and I met her. Me and Spencer, we had like a whānau dinner or something, and she met Spence and I met Rusty, you know, her husband, and then they started talking footy. And because at that time, Spence was like 28 years old. Gosh, that feels like a whole lifetime ago. And he was, because he's coaching Marlins topside, and he was like, man, bro, you should come give it a jam, because Spence has always played rugby. And to be honest, I used to go to watch him and go, oh, my gosh, I could be doing something else. You know, it didn't quite grasp my interest. But and then Carla kept saying, oh, come on, just tell them to come, you know. And I was like, oh. And he turned up one day, and he never looked back. He's like, why didn't I not play this game earlier? I just loved it. And so that's where it started. So I started as a wife on the sideline having drinks, you know, so I have empathy for people that sit on the sidelines at topside games, and I'd pace myself with my drinks. And then I stepped into like, oh, we need a manager for reserves. And I was like, oh, cool, yeah, I'd love to do that. And then, yeah, the rest kind of unfolded. At the same time I was at the Marlins, New Zealand Rugby League had advertised for an administrator at New Zealand Rugby League, and I thought, well, I've been working in Counties Manukau Sport, so you were everything to all sports. And I thought, gosh, I'd always loved rugby league. And the funniest story, I'm sure Cody's watching, I had the biggest crush on Clayton Friend as a free player.
Friend Whānau.
So he was like, oh my God, because he was like little, you know, he wasn't, but he was tough and good looking and fast and so good. So I was like, I had this soft spot for rugby league. And so I applied and I got the job. And so that was in 2007, not long after, because Tony Kemp, who is working there as well, and, you know, love him or don't love him, you know, he has, he's been a real pivotal part of my life in the rugby league world. He gave, I think, like you say, it was very male dominated. It was back then, I think he wanted to shift the mindset around women in the game. You know, so he, as the high performance manager he was back then, he brought me into the Kiwis squad as one of the team management. mainly around respect. It was really, it was beautiful how he threaded me in, because it was, wasn't really done before. And so I was his right-hand man, and the boys would attest to, you know, actually Auntie Combs did everything. He just told her what to do, which is true, which is true. But that's where my steps into that space began.
Nice.
Thanks to him, and I'm so grateful to him for it.
I think the rugby league community is grateful for Matua Kemp for doing that and bringing you in. And so with you coming into rugby league, I like that you've said that, because I think our wahine have more to offer than just administration and team managerial roles, like in terms of even, you know, whether it's coaching and development and pathways, like training, leadership. You know, there are so many great wahine in that space as well, and we need to encourage that. And bringing you into that space, obviously, really pivotal. And so you go from sort of doing that to tell us a little bit about it. Shifts a lot, because what you're quite renowned for now is being sort of this master and guru of all things player welfare and care and relationship. And you know, you, for anyone watching this, you only have to go on Google and type in Carmen Taplin, and you'll see photos of her. And I think I saw an article about with you in the Roosters house, looking after the boys, you and Spencer. There's a beautiful photo of you guys sitting with the likes of Roger and Jared and Joseph Manu and in the Roosters house. But so you shift from that sort of Kiwis in that managerial space, going into creating a space where you're actually actively looking after athletes. And in that space, how did that eventuate? How did that come about? And what was the heart behind doing that, Carms?
So in my Kiwi, so with Kiwis campaign, I was in the Kiwis campaign for 4 years. And it was pretty much, and back home, so again, we were involved at the same time with Papakura Seagulls, so K20s. That was probably, the K20s was our real pivotal, you know, that kind of turning point with Spencer and I, to go, geez, we could do some really good work, the two of us, in that care factor space. And our we had some beautiful boys in our team then, which all of them were beautiful boys, and that we still keep in touch with a lot of them. But Jazz Tivanga and James Bow, who have really kicked on in their footy, they were our captains, co-captains in that team. But at that time, so it was 2013, and the NRL in the 20s campaign had lost two young men to suicide within maybe a month or so. And they're both Pacifica, or Indigenous. And in my heart, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, one, we've worked with these boys here at Papakura and we have something. I wasn't quite sure what it was, but I'm sure we could offer more to the game, because I worried about back then our kids moving to Australia and not being understood culturally, or where was the gap? There has to be a gap. Why these things are happening around mental health. And so I honestly just sent an email to every NRL club that I could work out the email addresses for and said, hey, my husband and I do this. We would love to, if you have a house, we'd love to come. The Roosters, they came back and said, yes, let's work on this. And this was like almost a year in progress. Then they were like, yes, we'd love to have you. So I went on my last New Zealand Kiwis tour to World Cup in 2013. And then Spencer moved our family over while I was in the UK, and I moved back to Sydney and moved in with Spence to the Roosters house. But the real heart behind that was that why I brought up about being involved in Papakura 20s and the Kiwis at the same time, that's where my massive lessons around actually we're all human. Both ends of the spectrum suffer the same and have joy in the same things. But there's a significant pay difference. You know, for me in my head, I was like, you know, the Jared Warrior Hargreaves, you know, they get lots of money, but he is exactly like this boy I have at Papakura. The same, you know, the same barriers, the trauma, you know, relationships, all of that stuff. is the same. And that's when I quickly thought, well, actually, it doesn't matter who you are or how much your CV says, or you can talk to elite athletes. It was really humbling to understand that actually we're all human and our stories are so similar.
True.
And we all come from where we started. And that's kind of where it began.
And so on that, just to take a moment to pause and throw you sort of answered it, but I just want to really anchor it down as, why do you care? Because I'm sitting here thinking, listening, like, I think it's a great question, not because I asked it, but I think it's a good question to be asked, like, for all of us internally. Why do I care about that person or that group of people or that kaupapa? So if I was to ask you that, Carms, why do you care?
I think when I say the K20s, the Papakura Eagles 20s team, when I say to them, we say it to them all the time, how they don't understand how much of an impact they had and why we do what we do. It was the opportunity to work with them. And that's when we also realized that it's cool to win. You want to be a champion. That's awesome. But when I realized the richness in the journey is probably the winning for us. And so they taught me and my husband so much about, love, like, I get emotional thinking about it.
It's all right.
There's so many of those boys that even now who are still in Manurewa, who are still in Papakura, who are still doing what they do. But I think it was them showing us that just by giving that little bit of ourselves, how much it enriched their lives. And I was like, whoa, this feeling. Like we say all the time, we're never going to be rich because the second we get money or things, we straight away think, oh, we know someone who would be better off with this or who needs this more than us. And that all stemmed from our experience with those boys. I think we always had that heart because we had loved and lost, and we got through together. So then it was like our little job to make sure everyone else that may have been through similar, that we've supported them through. But these boys really opened up that whole, I can't believe that spending time with this boy on this day impacted him so deep that now he is this most beautiful father, this most beautiful husband. And they tell us, if it wasn't for ABC, I don't know where I would be today. So that is why we keep doing what we're doing, because the impact we can have is so great. Calm.
It's pretty special. And, I'm sitting here thinking, that when you care, it cares back. And hearing that, it really is in the, from a biblical perspective, it's in giving that you receive, right? It truly is in the outpouring. It even says again in the Bible that those who refresh others will themselves be refreshed. And when I see that and I hear you and I see your aroha and the tears, they're not anything to be sorry about. I mean, that's what caring means, eh? And that's why it's so important, because we see the simplicity and the beauty of what it is to be human and what it, and how much of a difference, like you said, being cared for can make, not just now, but in the trajectory of a person's life. To remember it wasn't all the things that are happening there. It's actually there was a couple of catalyst moments that, and a couple of key people, those significant key turners in my life that I come across that just shifted something in me. And that for them might change the world. And that's why now I say this. When I see yourself, or I see Spencer post photos of the K20 boys that have gone on into footy careers, and or even of those that haven't, but when you see them, you take photos and you post them up because you care. And it's all that history, and it's all that meaning, and it's all that aroha that doesn't go away, And I think that's really special. And I think that's something, again, the whole point of this conversation is, how do we have more of that in the world across every organization, across every level of leadership? It doesn't matter if you're a Fortune 500 or you manage the local New World down the road. Like, you can be good people. You can be good human beings. You can care with a real sincerity. And I love that, because I have a very similar philosophy that if I have it, I'll give it, right? If I have it, I'll give it. And when I hear you say that you'll never be rich, maybe financially, because the moment you get it, it's out the door, right? That's the heart, though, Carms. That's what it means to change the world and to do something different. So, you know, all of that. And I've seen, having seen your journey and learning more and more about it, and seeing the legacy through a lot of these players that just have a love for you and Spencer and what you've done for them, and the way they post photos up about you and embrace, that aroha and that love, because it's not that moment, eh? It's all the moments that have come the years before that no one sees. And I think that's a really great lesson for everyone, is that you can't go wrong investing in people, right? Is that it will always pay a return and pay a dividend if it's meaningful and sincere. But it takes time, and it takes of you to give. So with that being said, can shuffle us a little bit forward, I then come across your path, right? So we connect a couple of years ago now.
Yes.
And I connected through
best day of my life.
Bar Mary and Spencer.
And the birth of my children.
Other than that, third best day of your life. No. So we meet, and we meet through a beautiful person we both know, Kath. And and she was like, something's got to happen in this space for our wahine and for the game. And she said, she said to me, you know Carmen? I said, well, I've researched Carmen, but I've never met her, and we don't. So long story short, we connect and we meet. And you invite me to this initiative that you had got up and running as wellbeing manager for New Zealand Rugby League across the entire game, both through elite pathways right down to zonal and grassroots rugby league. You create this kaupapa called the Wellbeing Waka, and you did a whole lot of work around getting it up and running. And we sit down for a scheduled meeting in our calendar for an hour that goes, I think, about 3 hours, because we're both suckers for a good yarn. But I think beyond that, deeper than that, actually there was a real synergy between your heart and what you believe and my heart and what I believe, and our kaupapa aligned, and we could just talk. And in that, you invited me along. You invited me up to the offices to meet your boss, and we talked about having chaplaincy involved. Don't worry, I'm getting to my point. And then we finally get you to invite me. You invite me along to your kaupapa, which is the Wellbeing Waka. And I come along that night, and it was the first one was at Te Aritu, right? Because there had been some crisis that had occurred at Te Aritu, and it just seemed timely that you were doing the waka there. So I come along and I meet yourself there. I meet the club, but I meet your husband for the first time, and I sit in the session and I meet a guy who I now regard as a great friend, the legend himself, Ali Lautiti. But we're sitting there that night, and I'm listening to this kōrero about mental health and about the wellness of our people. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that kaupapa, about the waka, but more so why mental health or wellness is important to you and how you found yourself in that space?
Of course. It was such a, again, how we connected and how things have worked is just, that the wellbeing waka was, you know how you're in a role, because like I was, Nigel Wagner was the king of wellbeing at NZRL for years, and then he moved into another role and brought me on, and you know how you come into a space, and especially when you care so much about it, but you want to make a significant difference. And sometimes we go, I'm not very much of a strategic thinker. I'm not very business minded. So I wasn't going to come flying in with these, we need to do all these crazy things. I was straight away going, well, actually, these things are really cool and having a strategy and a plan. However, the heart of all of our, I suppose, you know, the in our game especially, and in our like Māori and Pacifica, like the suicide rates were huge. You know, again, the other motivation for us to move to the Roosters to house parent was because our young men were opting to take their lives instead of reaching out. And I understand the stigma around mental health and culturally, you know, from a Māori lens and a Pacifica lens, how sometimes we believe broadly it's something that's, you know, it's not a mental health thing, it's something greater. However, so I thought about simplicity of you know, and I thought, well, let's get to our people. You know, our communities had missed out on so much of New Zealand Rugby League's resource for years because it had, in wellbeing, in the wellbeing space, it had predominantly been funded for the elite pathways. So it wasn't that NZRL were just not caring about the communities. The money that was going in had to be spent in that elite pathway. Yeah. But then, so then I was like, well, surely, because this is where the heart, you know, our elite pathways start from our grassroots and being involved in clubland. I just this absolute immense passion for it, working with our K20s and understanding that those the issues that are there. And so then we thought, well, let's try and get some funding from somewhere and get around to our communities and, you know, be open and try and reduce the stigma around the conversation around mental health and encourage our people. And so that's kind of where it burst from. And it was just so, you know, like this is hit and miss, new. But to be honest, the whole time we did it, like we said, we didn't matter how many people we got to our sessions, as long as people knew we were coming and what the kaupapa was about and that we're there. That was just ultimately the most important thing. You know, we had to, there was no, oh, you know, you've got to meet criteria. I think it, to be honest, in the beginning, because we got a wonderful funder and so much support through Levar, and they, you know, we hand in hand. So we went into the kaupapa as doing that. Let's have just the talanoa. Let's have a kōrero around what does mental health look like for you with our young ones. So we'd split the group with our youth and then have parents in the other session. And then the other side of it, of course, was the education piece, because that's the thing. We can go and talk about something, but we wanted to empower our people and give them the education around the mental health. So for me, it was just beautiful. And we brought it together with Kai. So every session, the most important thing was
food.
We feed you too. We feed you too. Food and lollies, you know, but beautiful people. And I just think the time, so with the Te Aratu situation was we went there first, I think it was like a Thursday night, they were our first one, and Craig Godfrey, the most beautiful man who's the chairman now of that club and is just has the greatest heart for well-being and people. We had that session and sadly I think it was like the following week, one of the young men that was supposed to come to that session had taken his life. So they were severely impacted. And again, that we had recently teed up our sports chaplaincy arrangement with you and your amazing organization. And it was beautiful how the synergies worked and how quickly it was like, oh my gosh, you know, you guys and your crew just came in and supported that club beautifully in ways that I wish I would have been able to have the skill set that you've had. And I think that just set the tone for the rest, which the beautiful thing is you were involved the whole way through.
Yeah, so from that moment, I went to the first one and I was, to those things you said, Carms, overawed by or in awe of not just the session itself and the delivery, but the real heart, the heart that the people delivering it had, right from yourself and Spencer was there and Ali and the Levar crew, but also the hunger. So there's heart and hunger, right? The hunger of the club to want to change. And when I saw that, I was like, man, we've got to, not only do we got to be involved, but I think we can add some value. I think we can support the kaupapa. I think we can really see and help our people in a way if they want it. If they're, you know, we're here is all we're saying. So from that moment, I decided like any waka that I get invited to, I will happily come along because what a privilege it would be to be able to sit in the room and hear people's stories. And if we can help, then we'll help. And that led to, I think it was Waiuku was the next one. And we had some really rich conversation that night in the room. And that's probably one where I spoke a little bit more for the first time and shared on Invite By Yourself. And yeah, and I think it just grew and it's become this beautiful thing that is now, you know, it went from setting up and we went right around the country with it to clubs are now asking for it for their teams, and it is really being sought after. And it really lays a platform, Carms, for what you've created, which is how do we grow and how do we continue to expose more people to the conversation about their own mental health and their wellness? What does wellness look like for you? What does it mean to be well in our game, but also outside of our game? What does it look like? And you're absolutely correct. It's one thing providing elite pathways with wellness resource and support. But before they, you know, to become elite, you've got to be a junior and you've got to be grassroots. You come from somewhere, eh? And targeting that level, I believe, is absolutely and obviously the right thing. So you're still involved now, and I want to ask sort of two more questions as we get to talk about towards the end about what you're doing. But I wouldn't want to ask about what you're doing now in the wellness space if I didn't first ask about, if I can, you have a moko kauai. For you, I think it would be great to for us to hear your kaupapa around that and why that was so important for you and the significance of. Can I ask that? Is that okay for you to share a little bit with us?
Yeah, sure. This is a funny thing. My thing just fell out of my ear.
It's all right. You ducked out. Yeah, it's okay.
You have a coffee break? Oh, yeah.
Is that because I'm bleeding your ears with too much talking? It's slipped out.
My journey with my moko kauai is a beautiful, I think a lot of it is a lot of healing for me. And so I received my moko kauai on the 13th of January 2001, which was my baby girl Jordan's 25th anniversary of her passing. And my journey to get there was, I think, like I said, through my whole life, I struggled with some of the stuff that happened to me. So, you know, I had my early childhood trauma when I was younger. And my dad is a beautiful man. He passed away last January as well. And again, you know, when I was like, this is a fine example of someone saying, you know, if you need me, reach out. And, you know, you, Cliff, saying, Carms, if there's anything I can do. And most of the times, which I think we're all guilty of, I would say, no, it's okay, and we'll struggle. But I was like, actually, yes, I need you, and you were amazing for my family, and you still have been. But my dad was born in a marae, you know, in Te Awamutu, could only speak Māori. But it was the fear, they called him Kiha because he was white compared to his brothers and sisters. He had a different dad. And but back in this, you know, colonization and the language, he got in trouble for speaking it. So he more or less left Te Awamutu and moved to Auckland with this whole anti-Māori, you know, which broke my heart. So in me at school, when I'd say, I want to learn Māori, Dad, and he'd be like, no, Māori won't get you a job. Māori, everything, because of the negative impact it had on him. And so then here's this Māori girl going, oh, my gosh, I still went again. Like he said, no, you can't, and I did. He just didn't know. But I just had that deep sense of connection to our culture. But, you know, and I've always, and going through my trauma, so I kind of had a connection piece. So Dad had kind of cut off cut off a connection to our kaupapa, you know, our whānau from his end. And then with my personal trauma, with my mum's side, I was like this lost, like, oh my gosh, who am I? Who am I? And I think even the, when I would act up maybe as a teenager, et cetera, it was because I didn't really connect to who I was around my identity. And being proud of being Māori too, you know. So I don't speak the reo. You know what? I had every ambition to learn the reo as I'm older. But I honestly, I'm so terrible at learning. Like my learning is out the window. I listen to podcasts all the time. I don't know whether my learning, I think I have to be that, get in the classroom and learn. But I, again, I'm just like, oh, I don't have time. But that's my, one of my goals is to get, you know, to get there. But that decision to get it, it was mainly because I was proud of who I am. I wanted to connect and also to be, to empower others and my family and my mum and my nanny. You know, my nanny was the nanny that you just stay home and my granddad could do whatever he wanted, and she just took care of us and never drove. Because she, you know, so quite submissive, whereas I'm like the opposite. So I'm like, I wear that, and I'm so proud. I'm so proud.
That's amazing.
Being Māori and still learning that. Yeah,
I was going to say, you're making it sound like journey. If you rebel, you too can have an amazing career in rugby league. But I appreciate it. Again, Carms, you know, just I think it's important to, as we try and, you know, within an hour or so, trying to encapsulate someone's entire life in an hour is always very difficult. But I think trying to pull out some of these key things about your identity and your journey to that and acceptance of that is a very special, powerful thing, even from a leadership perspective, because I think we can't lead unless we know who we are, because you can't give what you don't have, right? You can't give what you don't have. And if you don't, you aren't innately aware of who you are and, from my perspective, who God has made you, how can you pour into anyone else if you don't have a real clarity about that or a sense of that? So that's really special to hear. Absolutely. So thank you for sharing that. And I sort of want to round the conversation off now at where you're at today. So for those watching and maybe even listening, we're having this conversation and you're all the way over in the Gold Coast and I'm in Manurewa at the moment, a beautiful but chilly day in Manurewa. But yeah, you're in the Gold Coast and you moved over sort of right between this window of COVID lockdowns and then it opens up and there's all these lottery things happening and then you go. But and it wasn't for a holiday. You moved for a specific reason. Do you want to share with us a little bit about now that move and what you're doing today, Carms? What you're involved in and where you're at?
Sure. So we decided, you're right, because we were house parents for the Warriors. Mm. So I'd worked for the Warriors for maybe 7 years. And we at the Roosters, I got homesick. Crazy. For that one. So we were there for a season. We came back home and then the Warriors started our house. And so we were house parents for them for like 7 years. And then the Warriors house closed, of course, with the boys all relocating to Australia. And that was our like turning point. We're like, well, actually, let's go and see. Let's move to the Gold Coast, see how it goes. Everyone was like, you're going, it's COVID. Everyone's coming home. But again, I was always that one. Well, if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. We didn't have jobs. Probably the greatest thing is because we'd given so much of ourselves to others and even our own kids probably missed out on a lot of our time because of what we were giving to others. But the beautiful thing with that is our kids would say, we get it. Sure. We see it. They need you more than we do at this current moment in time. So we're just lucky. So we thought, well, actually, let's give our time to our kids. Our two daughters came with us. And just try and get that work-life balance right, because it had kind of blown out of proportion as it does sometimes. So, yeah. So, and then when I got here, it wasn't too long after that, the Titans, it's just timing, one of the Titans well-being staff left, and they needed someone, and I turned up at the right time. And so I'm working there in the well-being space. Nice. I support with the boys, so the NRL squad, and but probably my main role is with the new NRLW, Titans NRLW team that started this year, or kind of started last year but then stopped and then started again. Yeah, so I'm working in there as a wellbeing manager for the girls and also team manager for their team. So doing a bit of two passions.
Keeping you busy, right? And so in that comes, you know, obviously you've moved there and you're in this wellbeing space too. And I want to land us at this place and a couple of questions, or maybe just a question around it. Or over all these years and all these roles within wellness and wellbeing, it does require leadership. And leadership can be a variety of different things, a combination of different things. It's not one specific thing or style, but I think there are some symmetries or similarities between great leaders and leadership that has greatness about it. If I was to ask you, Carms, if you reflect back on all of this kōrero we've had today, you are obviously a really good leader, and you, when you are relational with people, you're leading people, right? That's what relationship is, and you're leading them. If I was just to ask you quite simply, from your perspective, from your story, from your life and everything that led you to this moment, what would you say either makes the difference to being a good leader? A couple of simple things that you would say have really made the difference for you, or what you even think a good leader, an effective leader, really is?
I do like this little prezzo based on some really key principles that I think are almost they're imperative for me and the mahi that I do. And I'm not saying everyone else has to do it, but I think when you're working with people, like you said, it's so relational. At the end of the day, you can have, what I've learned in this space is you can have the flashiest gym, or you can have the most expensive hyperbaric chamber or whatever it is to make you breathe faster. If you don't have some really key things, I call it auntie's care package. So and the care for me is, the C for me is connection, is being able to connect to your people is ultimately so important. Like, there's so many times, because I'm working with athletes a lot, that's one of the first things if there's any disharmony, if they're feeling a little bit unsettled, it's a lot about they don't care about me. They don't even know who I am. They never ask me about, well, what about your partner, you know? So, again, this could be a head coach. This could be your CEO. So that's really important for me, connect. The A is authenticity. So that genuine, being genuine, you know. I'm sure it's in all spaces, but in the elite space, there's so, a lot of these players get smoke blown up their bum, or they're told they're amazing, but they know it's not real, you know, a lot of the time. So it's about being genuine in who you are, being authentic in your approach, you know. And they see it. This is the beautiful thing, is most humans will see it a mile away if someone's being a fake dude. And the R for me is respect and trust. So the greatest lesson for me is, and I love I was very honoured that you said I'm a leader, because I'm like, I didn't realise that. But the respect and trust. So for me, in any relationship, whether, there's your CEO, the head coach or whatever, there is like an expectation, well, I am this, so you must respect me. But I've seen in over the years is how much that isn't reciprocated. Whereas, I have the title, I don't need to do any work. So, but for me, I work so hard at earning the respect, in every relationship I have. It doesn't matter with who. I try my best to earn that respect and trust of the person. But the next step in that is, once I have it, I keep earning it. I honor it every day, and I will do everything in my power. So if someone messages me or emails me or calls me, if I don't get it straight away, I'll respond instantly. And that's simply because I get scared that if I don't, that those people will say, well, you that's said right. you were there for me, and I reached out and you didn't come back, so don't worry about it. So that's my greatest fear, and that's why I'm like, right, get back. And it also shows value of people. You know, it might be little. They might not think their thing is important, but I still want them to know you are important to me, whether it's big or small. All it takes is a little bit of time. So I think sometimes in leadership, and I've experienced it a bit of late, where that isn't nurtured as well as I think it could be. And the E for me, the last, is empathy and compassion. So the greatest thing for me is understanding everyone's stories, getting to know people's stories, and getting some understanding around why they might, you know, a player might be lazy or whatever. They might think, oh, he's just being disrespectful. But actually, we'll take that time and figure out what's actually going on, and understand, hey, this isn't an easy day for him or her. Yeah. So, yeah, there's a like. Auntie's my four fundamentals.
Amazing. They are amazing, and love it. And, you know, again, you've just exemplified and proven why you are the leader you are, and that you, and I can say that those fundamentals are four things that I know are evident and shine through and just ooze out of you calm. So well done. And thank you for sharing them with everyone that listens and watches this. I think it's important, you know, because there are so many people that won't see themselves as leaders or won't even think, because they've been demonstrated a form or type of leadership to them, and we box in what we think a good leader is. But actually, it's right down to what you said, and I love that. It's very real, caring, human things that we can all do and all lead in and be well, whatever level you're at, whatever level of leadership you're at. If you take those four things as part of Auntie Carms' care package, there you go. I know, and sincerely, I know that it's going to change and help so much in the lives of leaders and people as they apply them. So, look, Carms, that brings us to the end of our time and our cordial, all this formal stuff. I want to thank you for a number of things. First of all, for who you are as a person, for being in the world, for you and Spencer, for not just being in the world, but giving of yourselves to so many people. I want to thank you for your time here today, for all of your honesty, your sincerity, the depth of what you've said, but also the maturity of the help and the tips and the things that you've given today, the taonga that you've shared and given away, that people can take away, cherish, and apply in their lives. And then I want to thank you on a personal note, for being the friend that you are, for being the support that you are, and for also being a person that absolutely lives by what you talk about. And I think that is the greatest sign of mana and legacy and leadership that we should all be aspiring, is to be the people of our word and be how we say we're going to be, and be where we say we're going to be, and all those sorts of things. So, yeah, Carms, again, thank you so much. It's been a privilege to talk with you and to have you on the Render Gatherings podcast on the Uninfluencer Sessions. I hope that it wasn't too difficult. I hope that I did look after you. But, yeah, it's been a real privilege and an honor. Thank you so much.